But with Ecclesiastes and the time we have left, I want us to really focus in on chapter 2 alone, and I'm going to give you just a big picture overview, and then we'll dive in a little bit. Really, the first couple of chapters of Ecclesiastes, Solomon has the same theme. He's basically observing all of life, Ecclesiastes being the term assembling or gathering. He's collecting all that the world has for him and just observing what under the sun can the world provide. Can it satisfy my longings? And all of us deal with the same issue. What is it that will finally satisfy us? What is it that we will grab a hold of and finally we can just relax and go, we've arrived? Have you assembled some things in your life that you thought would give you more satisfaction? Maybe that new car or that house finally, if I can just find the right wife, if once we have children, if I can just find that one job or if I get that other degree, if I've assembled these things, finally, I'll just be able to relax and coast and enjoy everything. Have you arrived there yet? Or have you at least been guilty of trying to assemble things thinking that they may finally give us the satisfaction that we desire? There are many things in life that do give us joy and pleasure. Surely God gives us a whole world and planet to enjoy as we're, you know, just drive across the country, my family and I so enjoy and find much pleasure from seeing the varying topography of all of our United States. I mean, Georgia doesn't look like Alabama, and Alabama doesn't look like Mississippi, and I don't know why you'd want to go through Louisiana, but if you do, Kelly, no. You know, it's different. Has anybody ever had the privilege of driving through Kansas? What do you see? Just close your eyes. There it is. Yeah, but God has created these things, and He gives us the joy of that. But do they ultimately satisfy? Will it be enough? Will we be content in that alone under the sun? And Solomon says, I'm going to try. He had many more resources than you and I have. And he tries to assemble so many things looking for that soul satisfaction. In the first 11 verses, I believe he's going to have this. He's going to have self-indulgent delusions. The things that glimmer and sparkle and say, if you grab me, it'll be enough. And it's just the self-indulgent delusions. And we'll conclude the chapter here in case I don't get to it. Is that there are some sobering conclusions. Some sobering conclusion that he comes up with. Spending his life and energies and all things that he can assemble, gather, he's going to come up with some very sobering conclusions about that. You notice in verse 1 it says, I said to myself, you ever had those self-conversations, self? Driving the car, or sitting in your office. Come now, I will test you with pleasure. He's speaking to himself. Self, I'm going to test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. That's great words. If we're going to test it, just go ahead and go full blast, 100%, sold out to the pleasure that I'm going to assemble. And he starts here with this first category, I believe, of self-indulgent delusion, is entertainment. In verse 1 through 3, you're going to see, first he starts in verse 2, I said of laughter. So apparently, just starting there, he says, I'm going to surround myself with as much comedy as I can put around. Let's put so much joy that I laugh. Don't you just love that? Anybody seen like YouTube videos where you've had a baby in your house when you get them chuckling when they're like 6 months old? It is one of the funniest things I've ever experienced. You get one of those babies, there's one of those YouTube videos, by the way, that has like 8 kids on the bed. They're all like, you know, born of the same mother at the same time. And his mother's sitting there, and the dad makes some kind of weird noise, and all of them at the same time just start cracking up, and it just makes you cry when you laugh. It's just so funny. Laughter. He says, I'm going to go full-fledged into all of the joy of laughter and comedic influence that I can find. Is laughter bad? He goes on to say, I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Ken Davis is a Christian comedian. He tells of a true story of a time he was doing a concert or a gathering at a church. I mean, hundreds of people in the room, and he's sharing some stories, and everybody's just rolling on the floor laughing. It wasn't a laughing revival, don't mistake that. It's just a comedy thing, man. And so people are laughing. All of a sudden, the guy stands up, like about where Dwight is, stands up, and then just falls to the ground. They're thinking, oh, you know, he's really having a good time. And notice that he's not moving. Everybody stops. Ken stops. What do you do? The guy's having a heart attack in a comedy concert. He's like, well, I mean, we had to, you know, tell everybody just go. We had to take care of it. You can't go on with a comedy show when the guy's dying of a heart attack on the floor. And he's felt awful. He had to return the money to everybody, refund everybody. And a few days later, Ken contacted the gentleman to find out how he was doing. He survived. He's in the hospital. And he says, you know, I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have been so funny. I really affected you. I'm so sorry. And he says, man, Ken, I have had 3 heart attacks. And that was my favorite heart attack, my very best heart attack of all. True story. That laughter is good, but does it satisfy? The Bible tells us in Proverbs 14:22, a joyful heart is good medicine. A broken spirit dries up the bones. Some people reject humor because they think it's unholy or godly. I don't find that to be the case in the Scriptures. It'd be misplaced humor. But this is scientific evidence that laughter does the following. It reduces pain and allows us to tolerate some discomfort. It reduces blood sugar levels, increasing glucose tolerance in both diabetics and non-diabetics. Laughter is good for us. It improves your job performance, especially if your work depends on creativity and solving complex problems. Laughter establishes or restores a positive emotional climate and a sense of connection between people. Ask the 14 guys that were in Alabama this last weekend if there were a few laughter episodes. There was much to laugh about. I've got some stories. New evidence even suggests that laughter helps your blood vessels function better. Laughter's good. It actually acts as an inner lining of the blood vessels. There's this thing called endothelium, causing vessels to relax and expand, increasing blood flow. In other words, it's good for your heart and brain, the two organs that require steady flow of oxygen carried in the blood, and that is caused by joy and laughter. Him writing this, I don't think, suggests that laughter is bad, that we should squelch it because it's evil. But he is clearly stating that laughter and joy, this comedic influence of entertainment that we so try to embrace and gather, will not satisfy. You can laugh about problems all day. You can laugh about the various things, but eventually you stop laughing and you're off your little laughter high and you realize things are the same. Laughter's not bad, but it will not satisfy. He goes on from comedy to chemicals. Look at verse 3. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, is what it says in the New American Standard. Perhaps your translation says it. I tried to cheer my body or enjoy life or gratify my flesh with wine. While my mind was guiding me wisely in how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. Solomon was well known for how he could put on a feast, a festival, a party, and gather people. If you were to look back at 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 22, it says how much daily consumption happened in his home. Now, some of you have a grocery bill that's high. Some of you spend maybe $500 a month, or $750 a month, or maybe $1,000, maybe $1,500 a month. Some of you probably spend more than that. I wonder what it cost Solomon on a daily basis to feed all those he gathered around to enjoy pleasure. In 1 Kings chapter 4, let me just read it for you. The daily food requirements for Solomon's palace were 150 bushels of choice flour. Not just any flour, the choice flour. 300 bushels of meat. I don't even know what a bushel of meat looks like. 10 oxen from the fattened pens. This is every day. Pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep or goats, as well as deer, gazelles, roe deer, and choice poultry. That's quite a feast. Every day, the Scripture says, that Solomon had. He was able to put on a buffet you've never seen in your life. It did not satisfy, but on top of that, having these big parties, he would make sure that the alcohol was there to stimulate my body with wine, it says. Now, When I read that, I thought, is alcohol a stimulant or a depressant? Well, it's actually both. It just depends on the point of examination. I did a little research. Some of you nurses can check my facts. But, you know, when you do a Google search, you can find everything that's true. I found it says this, it is a depressant, specifically of the central nervous system. But because of the chemical properties in alcohol, wine specifically, it sometimes acts as if it is a stimulant during the early stages of drinking. Almost as soon as it is absorbed, the body starts to metabolize it, and at mild levels of intoxication, it stimulates the adrenal glands, causing them to discharge hormones. It is this action that accounts for alcohol's stimulant properties. But once you've been stimulated, it quickly begins to go down. I wouldn't know anything about this. I'm just explaining. It's like when it says in Hebrews chapter 11 about Moses grabbing onto the passing pleasures of sin. There are things you can grab onto, but they will not satisfy. They're not forever. They're not eternal, satisfactory stimulants. He says comedy is not enough. Chemicals and the things we can do to put into our bodies. Though you notice here, and the words are very clear, I wanted to point this out. He says he's stimulating his body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely. Whatever he is doing, he's not going with full abandonment to alcohol drunkenness. He says, I'm going to stimulate my body with the alcohol, but I'm going to keep my mind clear so that I can continue to examine whether this is going to satisfy me. You think entertainment's going to satisfy you, you will be greatly disappointed. The second thing he says, the area, I believe, is environment. In verse 4 through 6, he talks about changing his environment. He says, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. And I planted in them all the kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. When Solomon went to change the environment, to change the houses, and just imagine how many houses he had to build for all those wives and concubines. And imagine all these fruit trees that he had, and he built pools. You can still go to Israel today, I've been told. And there are still pools of Solomon that could hold enough water that would irrigate or water the groves of trees that he had planted. It's amazing what some people do this. They go, I'm just not satisfied. I just need to rearrange my furniture, make it look a little different. If I can change my environment, then I'll be satisfied. Is anybody married to somebody who just does that about once every 6 months? I've got to just change the look of everything. You walk in one night and you're tripping over furniture that wasn't there last night. I've already heard husbands tell me that about their wives. And in my home, it's me. I'm the guy who changes up everything. I just like change once in a while. But some people go, I'm just not satisfied in my house. I just think, if we just got another house, I think then I'd be satisfied. That would be the house for me for all time. It's amazing how if we think we just change the environment, it makes it all better. It does for a short time. Anybody been on vacation? You been to a beautiful place? How many of us, honestly, would just love to just live there forever? We'd be tempted to say yes. How many of us would be bored after a little while? You've seen it. How many people that live in resort areas just go, man, I just wish I could go to the United States and live where they live. We're never satisfied. Just changing the environment, external things. I mean, how many of you have ever cut your hair just thinking, if I just get shorter hair, it'll look better. I'll like it better. I'll feel better about myself. How many of you just wish, if I had hair, I would feel better about myself? It just goes on and on about the environment. He changes the scenery, but does it satisfy? Solomon was incredible. It took him 7 years to build the temple. The grand, glorious temple. He put a lot of effort into that. He also built his own home. You know how many years it took him to build his home? Now, you think about it. The temple, grand and glorious, the greatest temple of all time, took 7 years. How long do you think it took him to build his home? Yes, 2, 3? 14 years. 14 years. And I don't believe it was because he was slow. I think he really wanted to indulge in himself, saying, okay, we've built the thing for God. Now let's go ahead and take twice as much effort and build my home. environment doesn't satisfy, he says. I enlarged my works. I built the houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all the kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. But it doesn't satisfy. He also goes on in verse 7 to the enlargement. If I just gather for myself more things. I bought male and female slaves. I had homeborn slaves. There you go. You got the home birth right there with your slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds than all those who preceded me. More flocks and herds than all those preceded me in Jerusalem. Verse 8. Also, I collected, I gathered, I assembled for myself, the ecclesiastical nature here. I have collected for myself silver and gold in the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. He had the thought, if I can just gather a little more, perhaps this will satisfy me. He had a desire to acquire. Anybody been tempted by that? If I just have a few more things. I mean, Solomon was the quintessential Old Testament hoarder of all things. If I can just gather for myself, assemble all around me, all these things, people and servants and music and concubines, if I just have it all, then I'll be satisfied. If I just enlarge my territory. He was praying the prayer of Jabez. And he wasn't satisfied. Listen, is it wrong to have things? Some believe that. I don't think it's wrong to have things. I don't think it's wrong to gather money and purchase things of value. As long as we can retain the higher value of things that money can't buy. The love and the hope and the peace. The things that are greater than. And have things in perspective. Enlargement, he goes in the last three verses here, 9, 10, 11, with esteem. I see a category of esteem. If I can just think more highly of myself and look back at all that I've done and just admire all the satisfaction of what I've accomplished, surely that'll be enough. Verse 9. And just in your translation, perhaps you don't have the New American Standard. Just notice how many times he uses the word I, me, mine, my. Those words of personal influence. Verse 9. Then I became great and increased more than all those who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. Are you tripping over these? Thus, I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted. Behold, all was vanity, meaninglessness, striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun, no advantage at all. I mean, if I could just, I could be somebody, I'd accomplish more, that would satisfy me. Basically, Solomon's saying, I can have my best life now. And it's a fallacy, it's vanity. He gathered it all and was not content. I mean, he was a positive thinker. I mean, he looked for everything that was best in life. Now, there's some people who say it's wrong to have a positive mindset. You know, that as if a negative mindset's better. I do know this, a positive mindset and a good work ethic is better than a negative mindset and a lazy work ethic. So the positive thoughts of what you could do is not bad in its rightful place, but it still won't satisfy. I mean, I'm tired of the negative Nancys and the pessimistic Pauls of my life that just want to say, nah, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do this, blah, 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 it'll never work out anyway. No, go with all your gusto, but are you doing it for the glory of God or yourself, your own entertainment, your own environment, your own enlargement, your own esteem? That's where it's vanity. Philippians 4:8 clearly tells us, finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence in anything worthy of praise, dwell or think on these things. This I, me, and mine is just not working in God's economy for satisfaction. So it leaves us the first 11 verses, hitting the big areas of entertainment, environment, enlargement, and esteem, he comes to some sobering conclusions. Follow along. Look at verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom. I mean, he's making a turn. I've done all these things. I'm turning to consider the wisdom of, or the madness, or the folly of all of these things. And what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? This vicious cycle that he talks about in verse 1, or chapter 1. And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks around in darkness. I mean, he's restating here. He was clarity of mind, and he was going into all these pleasures with eyes wide open. A fool is the one who walks in darkness. Whatever happens, happens. I don't care. I'm just a free spirit. Woo! No, Solomon wasn't just this free spirit and said just whatever. He says, I'm going after it with a specific purpose. I want to know if all these other life's pleasures will satisfy me. I had my eyes open. My mind was clear. I knew what I was doing. So I'm not just some crazy man speaking. I did these things strategically and on purpose, and I am telling you, it will not satisfy. Then I said to myself, he's in this conversation once again with himself, which you may question his character there, but I think it's wise to question. As is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? I've been wise. I've been looking. So I said to myself, this too is vanity. He begins to ponder. People live wisely and people live foolishly and recklessly. But you know what? At the end, all the toys go back in the box and everybody dies equally. Doesn't matter how much wisdom you've attained or how much foolishness you've been able to express, we all die. And that's where he really is questioning. There, verse 16, for there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. That's pretty sobering. If you've had the wisdom and the resources that Solomon has, and he's done it all under the sun, and he comes to the conclusion and says, you know what, we all just die, what does it matter? And this is where I see two responses here. He has a hatred for that conclusion, a hatred of life. And I wrote it this way, hatred or hated truth leads to fear. The truth that, yes, we all die, he hates that truth. But it leads to fear. I'll explain that in a few moments. But then there is a holy truth that leads to faith. He shares with us at the end. This hated truth, look at verse 17. He uses it in 17 and 18, the word hated. So I hated life. Did he hate all the pleasurable things he had? No. He enjoyed them. They were pleasurable, but they didn't fully satisfy. But he hated getting to the end going, if I die, I'm just like the foolish man who wasted his life. So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility in striving after the wind. Verse 18, thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. I've worked it all, and I'm just going to die like the guy who had no job or did nothing with his life. And the fear begins to set in. I've spent my life with my wisdom doing what I thought was best. And in verse 18, he says, a little fear, I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. How many people have worked really hard for what they have and they leave it to their children for it all to be squandered in one generation? You've done everything that you know, I'm doing it right, I'm trying to leave an inheritance to my children, may I bless them, God has blessed me and I'm going to give it to them, and then it's just all gone. And you realize you have no lasting impact, no eternal contribution under the sun in your own power. It sets fear in his heart. He says, why do I work so hard when it's all just going to be washed away? I have done all these things. I and my work and my labor and all the things I've done under the sun, under my own power, I've done it all, and it's all just going to disappear. Like quicksand through the fingers. It's just going to, poof, like back to that bubble. It's just, I got it, and then boom, it's gone. It's pretty sobering. Verse 20 goes on. With this fear, therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil. For what does a man get in all his labor and in all his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous, and even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. He gets to the crux of the truth here, and I'm glad he gives us a little glimmer of hope here. Ecclesiastes can be extremely depressing as you read through it, and you don't get many glimmers of hope, but here he gives just a little nugget here. The holy truth that leads to faith as opposed to the fear. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink. And this is not a law. This is a wisdom literature. So therefore, he's just saying, yeah, there's some good things. You can eat and drink and tell himself that all his labor is good. But this, all that we ultimately do in this life, this also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. The greatest blessings of life are from God. James clearly states that every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no very shadow. All that he does, if he can just get a glimpse that it's God who has enabled him to accomplish. But the Scripture in the New Testament tells us, for whether we eat or drink, or whatever we do, and all of us will eat, and all of us will drink, and all of us will do some things. The difference between under the sun and over the sun and the satisfaction that you're looking for is, do you do it for the glory of God? Because it's the glory of God that will be eternally exposed and influential. It is the only thing that will transform lives. When we get to the end of our life and we say, we've worked so hard and nothing will become of it, the next foolish person will pick it up and do nothing with it. Well, were you working for yourself or for God? If you're a worker of God and you find much pleasure in that, you trust Him with it. And you trust His will to accomplish all that He desires, and you will be satisfied. Some of us are still, even in the Christian realm, not satisfied because we're still working for ourselves and not eating and drinking and doing everything for the glory of God. He gives us the next phrase in verse 25. I love it. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment? What does it say in your translation? Without Him? Who can really enjoy this life anyway? Even though you can physically assemble some things for yourself without God, who can really enjoy it for its purpose without Him? Satisfaction is a gift of God that only comes through Him. So he says in verse 26, for a person who is good in his sight. Not quite sure that communicates well. Fortunately, some other translations do help you. Perhaps your word has pleasing in it. Those who please the Lord. Because no man is good. But for a person who is able to please the Lord, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. While to the sinner, he has given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to the one who is good or pleasing in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. Can we ultimately please God? Is it, say, works-based intention of his teaching? I don't believe so. I think if you were to cross-reference this back to Hebrews in your New Testament, when it talks about what it takes to please God, Hebrews 11, chapter 11, verse 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. And faith is that heart of trusting God, to glorify Him, to trust Him in all things. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is the rewarder of all who seek Him. Solomon was seeking satisfaction in all the wrong places. Had he sought Christ first, had he sought God in all his kingdom first, all the other things, Jesus says, will be added to you. But seek His kingdom and His righteousness. It's where we skip. We miss it. That's some truth out of Ecclesiastes chapter 2. I believe there were some other things, and I commend it to you in your own meditation. But let me just challenge as we close. You must ask yourself, what really satisfies me? Do I try to seek it from entertainment or environment or some type of aspiring to acquire some, you know, or just thinking more highly of self? Have we recognized the hand of God in our lives? And have we surrendered to God in such a way that all things that have been provided can be truly enjoyed with Him, but not without Him?